Journeys have a way of delivering you to destinations different than the ones you intended. Jeff Greenwald has journeyed across 5 continents, recording the unexpected destinations he reached in works such as Mr. Raja's Neighborhood, Letters from Nepal, Shopping for Buddhas, and The Size of the World. In his latest work, Snake Lake, his journey is about liberation, political and personal, as he experiences the people power uprising in Nepal, the transformative power of Buddhism, and the emotional impact of witnessing a brother slide towards suicide. I'm Dave Mazza, and Jeff Greenwald joins me today to talk more about these journeys. Welcome to KB Radio Zane, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Well, really want to just jump right into it. And as I said in the intro here, Snake Lake is really a story of liberation, or more than one story of liberation, really. And I guess the big background story that all of this plays out against, of course, is the political turmoil in Nepal. So perhaps we could talk a little bit at first about, you know, how you ended up there covering that story and what you saw unfold.
Sure. Well, I was living in Nepal on and off from 1979, which was the first time I ever visited. I arrived there in September of about 1989, and it became clear that things in the country were taking this strange path that I'd never seen them take before. There was this big dispute with India. Now, Nepal and India have really very strong historic ties and cultural ties. The Buddha was born, for instance, in Nepal, then moved down to India to teach. And of course, the Hindu culture is shared by both countries. There's an open border, more or less. Let's just say there's no mountains. You can just go right up from India to Nepal very easily on the road. So their long relationship was threatened in late 1989 by this crazy, stupid thing the king of Nepal did. Now, I have to tell you about this king. His name was Sri Panch Maharaja Birendra Bibikram Shahdev. And his family, the Shahs, had been ruling Nepal for about 240 years. And at that time, the late 1980s, Nepal was the 5th poorest country in the world. King Birendra was the 5th richest man in the world.
A poverty gap.
Definitely a gap there. So, you know, we all have read a lot of stories about kings and kingdoms and how certain kings can be good kings and other kings can be not so good kings. Birendra, not so good a king. He was feeling a little hubris and went ahead and did something that he really should not have done. He went and bought a bunch of arms from China. And this was strictly against the treaty that Nepal had with India.
And inflammatory in light of India's long conflict with China over their borders.
Totally inflammatory. So India, Rajiv Gandhi was the prime minister at the time, and he called King Birendra to task. And King Birendra essentially said, you know, forget it. We're a sovereign country. We have the right to do whatever we want. Don't tell us who we can't buy arms from. So India said, okay, if that's the way you feel about it, here's what we're going to do. And Rajiv Gandhi ordered that all the border crossings from Nepal to India be closed. Now, this is 1990, before China had started building all these roads over the Himalayas. There was no way to get into Nepal except through India. So in a heartbeat, Nepal, it was like a pillow had been put over the country's face. Mm-hmm. It was strangled. No oil, no medicine, no cotton for clothes, no silver for the jewelers. Nothing could get into Nepal. And of course, the king wouldn't budge because kings don't budge. That's part of what makes them a king. And the people started to get more and more disgusted, waiting, you know, full days online for things like kerosene or basic medicines, having nothing for their kids in terms of oral rehydration fluid. Really bad situation. At the same time, take yourself back in time a little bit, 1989, 1990. What's happening? Big revolution in Romania, the dictator overthrown. The Berlin Wall comes down. This news is getting into Nepal through the BBC, even through the state organs like the Rising Nepal newspaper, and they're thanking themselves, you know, we deserve democracy. Why don't we just throw this bum out?
Right.
This kind of talk had never happened in Nepal before in the 10 years I'd been going there. Here it was, and people in Nepal who'd been under a all omnipotent king for 240 years, a king who was thought to be an incarnation of the god Vishnu, the great preserver of the Hindu Trinity, they're talking about throwing him out of the palace and having democracy. So I was there. I was, I'd been a journalist since the mid-70s, and I found myself in Nepal at this time. And I started to realize this country could be heading towards revolution. And there was plenty of talk of revolution in the air, and there were protests, and the police were out gunning down protesters. Thousands of students were being thrown into prisons. And I just thought to myself, this is great. I mean, not only do I want Nepalese to throw off this yoke of monarchy and have democracy, but I would love to be there when it happens and potentially, selfishly, but realistically, make a name for myself as a journalist. Revolution in Shangri-La. I mean, what's not to love about
what
that?
What a headline.
Right,
yeah.
So there I am. At this point, it's February 1990. I'm in Nepal. I'm hanging on to see if this revolution's coming or not. Anything could happen. You know, there's no guarantee that a revolution's ever going to really happen. At the same time, I decided to look into a cultural aspect of Nepal that I'd been familiar with for years but never taken that seriously, which was Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I'd studied Hinduism. I'd loved the Hindu myths and legends, read the Ramayana, read the Mahabharata, and, you know, knew all about the different gods and goddesses like Ganesh with the elephant head and, you know, Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth. But I'd never paid much attention to Buddhism. So a friend of mine in Nepal, a doctor who was originally from Portland, his name is changed in the book, but his real name was Dr. David Schlim. He had a very close relationship with one of the lamas there, this brilliant, charismatic young lama, about a year older than me, whose name was and is Choki Nima Rinpoche. So Dave Schlim brought me by to visit the lama during his Saturday teachings, and I immediately was struck by the rational, sensible, scientific approach to living in the world that Buddhism had to offer, and began to attend the Saturday teachings regularly.
Well, you put the word scientific out there, and I think for most people, when they think of Eastern religions, it's mysticism. It's, you know, if anything, as far removed from rational scientific thought as possible. So explain that to me a little bit.
Well, I think when we think about science, we think about one thing about science is that results are verifiable. Okay, basically, there's peer review. You get a result, it gets tested. If it doesn't work, you throw it out. And that's basically what the Buddha said. Buddha, the historical Buddha, Gautama Siddhartha, laid out this formula for liberating your mind, for freeing yourself from suffering. He talked about what he called the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, very systematic, very, very good for people who are, for instance, illiterate and use these sort of number devices to remember things. And he presented these teachings, and then at the end, among the last things he taught were, test these things, test them on yourself. If they don't work, get rid of them. If any of the things I've taught you are false or don't work, throw it out. It's wrong. I was wrong. And to me, that's a very scientific way of looking at creating a belief system and living by it.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the things that Buddha taught basically are completely logical, and it's impossible for any rational person to find much fault with them. The primary teaching of compassion being that all living things suffer in very much the same way. We're all imperiled by sickness, by the inevitable ends of our lives, and that the least thing you can do for any other human being is pay it the respect of not increasing its suffering, because all life by its nature is suffering. It all leads to death. There's no way out of that cycle. So you don't have to love your neighbor, but, you know, don't make life any more difficult.
Right, exactly.
It's the least you can do. And I found that very, very logical. And I found Buddha's approach very scientific.
So this lama that you encountered, first of all, I should say this was an actual individual. You weren't doing like a composite of experiences you had with different religious leaders, right?
No. Some of the characters in the book are slight composites, and some characters were changed because the actual characters asked that they not be used in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of Choki Nima Rinpoche, he's still an active teaching lama in Nepal who travels all over the United States and Europe. And in fact, he was very tricky because, you know, lamas are very particular about the way they teach. So all of the chapters in the book in which Choki Nima Rinpoche appears are based on tape-recorded sessions that I did that were then edited and vetted by his translators for accuracy.
What was it that resonated with you? I mean, you said it was rational, it was scientific, it was very appealing that way. But what else resonated with you that made you connect in this way with him as well as with, you know, with his teachings?
I think that one of the things that made me resonate so strongly with this particular teacher was his kind of, I wouldn't say suspicion, because I don't think he had really suspicion, but his, his tendency to sort of step away from dogma. Tibetan Buddhism can be a very, or seem like a very dogmatic religion with its opulent gods. There's almost a pall of Catholicism in terms of the pomp and circumstance attending lamas, the outfits they wear, the ritual objects they use. Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche always brought things down to the basic. For instance, one thing that a lot of Tibetan teachers do and their students ask them to do is this thing called a mo, which is a mystical reading. You throw certain stones or objects and you read, you divine an answer to a question from that. Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche would never do mos. He just, you know, he would never do them. He just, I don't know if he believed in them or not. He just didn't think they were a good way to arrive at the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this one incident that I put in the book and it stuck with me because it was so amazing. In terms of his sense of humor and the way he taught, the Tibetan publishing companies put out a calendar. And every year there's holidays during which the merit you gain from good actions is multiplied. And the bad karma you get from bad actions is also multiplied. We're not talking about multiplied two or three times, like 40 billion times, right? So I think I make the point in the book that on a certain holiday, giving a beggar a single grain of rice is like the equivalent of giving them a year's worth of, like, you know, organic produce.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just, it's a lot. So during one of the teachings, there was this woman there in the room. I think this German woman, very worried. She looked at the calendar and realized that the next day was one of these full moon Buddha days where any action was multiplied thousands of times. And she said, I don't know what to do. I'm going to have so many problems that day. And the Chökyi Nyima tried to convince her, no, it's really nothing to worry about. It's just a day where you should be especially aware of your actions. Just bring that much more mindfulness to the things you do. And she was going, no, I looked at this calendar and I think we're all going to have a lot of horrible problems this day. And Chökyi Nyima just threw up his hands and said, it's your problem. You bought the calendar. And I just loved it. And it was just like he just in one fell swoop dispensed with all the dogma and all the superstition and just brought back down to basics. You know, egolessness, compassion, formlessness. These are the basic teachings of Buddhism. And everything else he pointed out is really just dogma and superstition.
Now, you were also dealing, as this journey continued, there was another personal aspect to it in terms of your relationship with your brother. And I'd be interested in hearing a little more about that as well, as especially within the context of your exploration of Buddhism.
I think a lot of people who live in the Portland area have been to Nepal or been to Asia and traveled there. And I think that they really realize that when you're in Nepal or living in one of these countries, especially for an extended length of time, you get so immersed in that world that you almost forget that any other world exists. That was certainly true before the internet was such a huge presence in our lives. When I was living in Nepal, covering the revolution in 1990, it seemed like that was really the whole world. And then from the outside, these letters began to arrive from my brother, who was 3 years younger than me and a brilliant, brilliant scholar and linguist who spoke 22 languages, read and wrote in 22 languages. Absolutely amazing athlete and scholar. And I knew my brother had been depressed for about 6 or 7 years. But these letters I was getting indicated a sudden spiral into what seemed to me to be a dire, dire depression, one that probably could really lead only to one place. And they were based around something that I don't really want to talk about during the show. It's spelled out pretty well in the book. Just a personal crisis he was having about his sexual identity. That was my reading of the situation. And these letters would just bring me back to this other world, so far from the world of sort of Buddhism and examination of your inner state that I was looking at. And it was clear that my brother was just sort of in this real trap, this endless loop with his own ego. Like when you're the most important thing in your own world and your foundations begin to collapse, your whole world collapses. And that was going on with my brother. And then the question really arose and became the foremost thing. What do I do? Do I stay in Nepal and wait for this revolution, which may or may not ever happen?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I go back to the United States and try to see what's up with my brother and try to, you know, at least talk to him on the phone and have some contact with him? And I decided ultimately to go back to the United States and try to deal with that situation as best as I could.
Reaching that decision, did you find, well, one, I'm assuming it was a difficult decision to reach having covered this political drama for so long, and here it was finally reaching that point where it might all, as much as these stories come to a conclusion, it may well be coming to a conclusion that you wanted to cover. But in what ways had your experiences with Buddhism helped you to, how did you reach that decision? Was there like at a moment, the epiphany? Okay, I know this is what I need to do. This is what is right. Or did it continue to be a kind of, I guess this is what I'm going to do. I guess it's going to be right.
I think that it was a hard decision because I was also involved in a very intense relationship in Nepal that had just really started with a female photojournalist that I'd met there, who I was really sort of getting under my skin, and I remember that the decision to go back came when I was at a temple that it's commonly known as the Monkey Temple, Swayambhunath, in Kathmandu, and I'd just gotten another letter from my brother, and I'd realized at that point that I just had to go back. And in terms of Buddhism, I don't really think Buddhism affected that particular decision. It was just really a filial thing, a thing of family loyalty. I just had to go back, and I knew it. I'd always been planning to go back around that time, and I'd extended my ticket thinking the revolution was going to come. But who knew? The revolution, there's all these setbacks. People seemed to be really afraid of the king. And it just seemed to me I could wait here forever, or I could just go home as I planned and, be there and talk to my brother. And I decided to just keep my ticket and go home as I planned and see what unfolded. After the events with my brother had played themselves out, Buddhism again became very important because I had to deal with his death. And not only just his death, but self-inflicted death. And that was something that, there's a lot of, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn when I can say that I would imagine that at least one of every two people listening to the show has dealt with suicide. It's a big, dark secret in many families, among many people. After my brother died, a lot of people came out of the closet and told me that they'd had siblings or parents or partners who had also killed themselves or best friends. And it's like this plague. And yet, on the other hand, it's also a choice people make. And, this is, we're just scratching the tip of an iceberg here. Any talk about suicide could go on.
Certainly.
But let me just say that Buddhism kind of helped me understand that that I wasn't to blame necessarily for what happened to my brother, that it was a choice he had made. And in terms of sort of providing whatever blessings or goodwill or wishes or good intention that might make his next incarnation, if such a thing were to happen, a more peaceful one. I tried to bring those tools to bear.
So in that respect, it did provide a sort of a liberation for you, at least, in dealing with this situation. I mean, as opposed to where many people would end up going, of being, the endless, what could I have done? What should I have done? What didn't I do? Sort of.
Yes, that's very wise observation. I think that by the end of the process, and the process never ends. It's ongoing. The relationship with the person, the suicide person, always continues in a different way. But I think by the end of the story of Snake Lake, I do attain a kind of liberation, and I understand that I've done all I can. And once you've done all you can, you really can't do anything else. And to accept that and honor that and just respect yourself for having done that and respect the person who's made the choice to bring their life to an end for having made a difficult decision, as painful as it was to everyone around them. Those are things that it was helpful to have Chökyi Nyima's teachings on my side.
Now, to bring this back around to where we started, of course, you were still at least keeping an eye on what was happening in Nepal even
Absolutely.
After you returned.
Oh, yeah.
What were your, what's your sense of how, at one point, clearly the people finally demonstrated that they were fed up with the king in a very dramatic way.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of how that unfolded and where Nepal has ended up?
Okay. the 20 years in a nutshell.
That's it, yeah.
Well,
no pressure here.
The revolution is a matter of record. It occurred on April 6th, April 8th, 1990. I was not there. We read about the events of that incredible, tumultuous time through the eyes of my female character, the photojournalist Grace. So they threw out the king. They became a constitutional monarchy. The king, who had been such a buffoon and a fool before the revolution, was kept in the palace as the only way really of uniting this incredibly disparate country of more than 90 different ethnic groups. And he became a symbol of Nepal's commitment to peace and a symbol of the unification of Nepal, a beloved leader. Unfortunately, the people who took over the government of Nepal were as venal and corrupt as the royal family had been. Maybe they meant well, but after nearly 2.5 centuries of despotic rule, there was just no habit, no precedent for just good rule, and they couldn't pull it off. They struggled back and forth. Then in 1995, there was a Maoist insurrection. This whole faction of the country got fed up. They formed a Maoist army and plunged Nepal into 10 years of civil war, which cost more than 12,000 lives. In the middle of that civil war, as if things weren't horrible enough, Crown Prince Dipendra, the son of the royal family, on a drug-induced rampage, pulled out an automatic weapon at a family gathering and killed all his relatives, including King Birendra, the queen, his brother and sister, his aunts, his uncles, his grandmother. All of them were gunned down. So this now beloved royal family that had been the glue holding the country together, in one horrible evening on June 1st, 2001, was slaughtered. And Nepal's spirit at that point was probably pretty broken. I would have to say they've never really recovered. Though the Maoist insurrection ended in 2005, and a second revolution kicked out the king entirely and made Nepal a republic in 2006, they're still struggling to put together a constitution. They're still just fighting amongst the three parties, the Maoists, the Nepal Congress Party, and the royalists who want a king back, jockeying for position and power. There's no clue when they're going to have a constitution ready. They're already way overdue. And the capital city is pretty much in chaos. It's like no one's really minding the store. If ever a group of people in the world deserved a good king, a just king, and good governance, it's these wonderful, generous, brilliant people of Nepal. And it's something that's eluded them these many years.
Now, beyond the level of, the rather dramatic struggles amongst the royal family, I mean, it sounds like something out of one of the Indian epics, but did you see the sort of sectarian violence filter down at the grassroots level that unfortunately also is one of the legacies of the liberation movements of the 80s and 90s as happened in, say, the Balkans? Was there any sort of impact going on at that grassroots level where you saw a lot of, unpleasant fighting going on or destruction?
You mean during the Maoist revolution?
Right, yeah, during the Maoist revolution. Yeah. I'm thinking, are we seeing parallels to what happened in Cambodia or something like that, which, again, you could also speak to.
Yes. Nothing like that, really. I think the values of Buddhism and Hinduism and family, there was a lot of horrific violence during the Maoist Civil War in 1995 to 2005, but it was mostly out in the villages. It never really came very strongly into the Kathmandu Valley itself, and I never witnessed any of it. Some journalists did get out and speak to people. Very few journalists that I've ever spoken to, even from the most major media, witnessed atrocities actually being committed. There was always the aftermath. No, the Nepalese are basically a very peaceful, almost passive people in many ways. I know that the Gurkhas belie that reputation, but in general, they're a very peaceful people. And you really didn't see the same kind of mindless, wholesale genocide-type slaughters that you saw, say, in Cambodia. They had child soldiers in Nepal. They committed atrocities, but there was no killing fields kind of situation. Millions of people were killed in Cambodia. Millions of people were killed in these wars in Africa and so forth. The total death count in Nepal was 12,000 over 10 years, which is still a lot, but, it's not
in the grand scheme of things, incredibly light, all things considered. As we wrap up here, I would be interested in just getting a little bit of your thoughts about the actual structure of the book, because this is an interesting book in many ways. There's some people would say, you're a travel writer, and this is sort of a travel book. It's straightforward, journalistic reporting as well, but it's also a memoir. And I mean, you've woven in a lot of different things. And I'm curious what your thinking was of wanting to do it that way, or was that the only way you could see that the story would be told?
It would be much more convenient for me if my brother had taken his life when I had been just, you know, snug home back at my home in Oakland, California. Unfortunately, I was also in the middle of this other terrifically interesting story while that was unfolding. I didn't see how I could tweeze the stories apart. So I felt I had to tell these stories at the same time. And in fact, the whole idea of liberation through Buddhism, liberation through revolution, and liberation through suicide, that they were all connected in that strange way, didn't occur to me until long after the events had passed. I structured it. I wrote the book the only way I knew how. It was a very difficult book to write and a real departure from my books like Shopping for Buddhas or The Size of the World, which are just romps. Mm-hmm. There's parts of them are serious, but they're also just fun romps. Snake Lake is a much more kind of serious book. And I don't know if we have time, but I'd actually like to address one question you haven't asked.
The title.
Thank you.
I was going to end with that because I know we'd be remiss if we left it that way.
You read my mind. Thanks. It's great. I often forget to mention why it's called Snake Lake. In prehistory, the Kathmandu Valley was an inland sea, and it was called Nag Hrad, the tank of the serpents. Now, before really human history as we know it, a saint named Manjushri came. He cut a huge gorge in the foothills around the valley, and all the water drained out. The race of snake gods that had inhabited this lake had to flee. They're called Nagas, snake gods, mm-hmm. and they fled into the small aquifers and ponds scattered through the Kathmandu Valley after the valley was drained. And the most revered of these is a place called Nag Pokhri, which means snake lake, which was a watery shrine near the house I lived during the time I wrote this book. And I also love the metaphor of snakes. These, you know, in Nepal, snakes are dangerous, but they're also guardians of the monsoon rains and the underground gems. So there are these forces under the surface of things, in the subconscious, if you will. And we bring them to the surface, you know, sometimes to our benefit and sometimes to our peril.
Well, Jeff Greenwald, it's been a pleasure. I think Snake Lake is a remarkable book, and I'm certainly hoping all of our listeners will take the time out to read that, and as well as be looking forward to seeing what you're going to work on next. I'm sure you have something in the hopper. But again, thank you for coming on down to KBOOV and joining us this morning on the KBOOV Radio Zine, and we look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thanks, Dave, for one of the most intelligent interviews I've ever been privileged to give.
Thank you very much.